Hello and welcome to Theatre Voice. I'm Alex Sears and today I'll be discussing the highs and lows of publishing theatre books with my guest Nick Hearn, who is one of Britain's foremost providers of play texts and books about theatre. Born in 1944, he studied drama at Bristol University and taught the same subject at Hull and Glasgow before moving into publishing. His company, Nick Hearn Books, celebrates its 20th anniversary this year, and its impressive roll call of published plays include many of the most talented playwrights of the past few decades, everyone indeed from Carol Churchill to Conor McPherson. In addition, the company also produce a wide variety of books by theatre professionals. Welcome to Theatre Voice, Nick Hearn.
Thank you.
To start off, let me ask you about your experiences of academic life. How was it?
Well, what happened was that I so enjoyed my degree at Bristol as a student that I was a little bit reluctant to enter the sort of the wacky world of work, but in a sort of contrary frame of mind, feeling that I really didn't want anything to do with academia. I got myself a job in an advertising agency for which I was wholly unsuited, and realised that I was within about 2 weeks of joining, and then spent 2 years trying to get back to where I'd been happiest, which was within a university drama department. Unfortunately, at that time, they were opening not exactly one a month, but several drama departments opened within a short space of time, and they were all relatively. They all found it relatively difficult to find staff because there was only one drama department, which was Bristol, and therefore the supply of graduates, and particularly the supply of graduates who wanted to teach, was very small. So I more or less fell into a job. I mean, these days you have to have 6 PhDs before you can even apply. I didn't have a second degree. I just had a good first degree and a specialisation, because the other half of my degree was German, so I had German and drama. And Hull Drama Department, which had only really opened its doors the year before, this being 1967, and it sort of opened for business in 1966, there were only three members of staff when I joined, and I was the fourth, and my job was to look after various aspects of the syllabus. And it was great, because we were making it up as we went along. Mm. I mean, we were writing the syllabus, and very close to the students, and it was one of the times of my life, I must say, those 5 years at Hull and then the 2 years in Glasgow.
So how come you gave all that up, the safety of that and the thrill of doing that, for the kind of perilous waters of publishing?
You've hit the nail on the head. I thought I was a career academic at that point. Mm. I'd even got tenure, which, if you talk to academics now, is terribly precious. Mm. And means that basically they can't dispose of you without paying you large sums of money, as I understand it. But what happened was that as an academic, or as someone operating in the drama field, I'd made it my business to get to know probably the most active publisher that there was at the time, which was Geoffrey Strawn at Methuen. Got to know him because I suppose that eventually I hoped he might commission me to write a book, which is what you had to do as an academic. But meanwhile, I was writing reports on various things for him, you know, manuscripts that came in. And one day the phone went, one day in 1973, the phone went, and Geoffrey said that he'd just been promoted. He was brilliant, and had been responsible for bringing, for the Monty Python books, for instance, which made a lot of money. So he was being promoted to managing director, having been drama editor, and said, did I want to come and be drama editor? My first reaction was exactly what you've said. I said, no, thank you, Geoffrey. I've got a very good job, and it gives me masses of holiday a year. But I then put the phone down and started to think, because I was feeling Glasgow in 1972-73 was quite a foreign place for someone who'd been born, brought up in the southeast of England. I can tell you, it felt very foreign. And I sort of thought, do I really want to spend my life? And all the drama departments at that stage were all in the regions. And I thought, as a Londoner and also as a theatre lover, do I really want to spend the rest of my working life outside London? And also, isn't this an astonishing opportunity? How often would one be offered the job of drama? I mean, drama publisher, you know, there are only about four in the whole of the country.
Yeah.
And here I was being offered one, so I rang him back and started on April Fool's Day in 1974.
And how long did you stay with Methuen then?
Well, Methuen lasted for very nearly 15 years.
Yeah.
Again, I thought I was there forever, but partly actually because I think this is right, and it's meant as a backhanded compliment, that partly because Geoffrey had been so very successful, he went on to bring The Secret Diary of Adrian Mole to the list, and Methuen became, it was the end of the 80s, and there was a lot of corporate shenanigans going on. A lot of big publishers were buying up smaller publishers, and Methuen became what they called in those days a takeover target. And indeed, it got taken over not once but twice within 12 months, and it was thoroughly, thoroughly unsettling for the people who worked there and also for the authors. And out of all that came a letter from a man whom I hardly knew, but who was doing some work with Methuen Children's Books, but had set up a very successful children's book enterprise of his own, Sebastian Walker. And his goal, I think, was to start acquiring publishers who were operating not in children's book areas, but in areas that he himself was interested in. He was a great opera goer and a theatre goer. And I think had he not subsequently got seriously ill and died, he would actually have made a bit of a sort of Walker Books empire. I don't know what else he mightn't have acquired, but he was also very keen on the visual arts, and I imagine he might well have. I think his family was very wealthy. I think he was worked for. I think the family was Walker Engineering. You sometimes see their nameplate I've seen their nameplate on old steam engines, but I think they came. But there was money in the family. Plus, he'd made a lot of money out of children's books, and there was a sense that he kind of wanted to spend it in an entrepreneurial way. So he just wrote to me out of the blue and said, "I must be having a very unhappy time at Methuen. Would I like to come and start a drama imprint with him?" And it was another of those moments where I thought, "Oh God, you know, I'm." Drama editor of the best, I think it's fair to say that it was the best drama list at the time. Faber were the only other substantial publishers, and they had lots of other fingers in the pie, as we know. You know, they were doing fiction, non-fiction, poetry and all sorts of stuff. But Methuen had a kind of very, very strong editor. So there was I, presiding over the best drama list in the country, but being offered the opportunity at a time of enormous upheaval to sort of start again. And actually, Harold Pinter had got so angry, he was getting angry even in those days, Harold had got so angry with the situation at Methuen, he'd taken his new play very ostentatiously off to Faber, which was a kind of big blow, and Simon Gray had followed him. And there was a sense that, you know, that we were sort of, you know, Methuen was, if not quite hold beneath the waterline, you know, there was a problem, and I was doing spending far too much time firefighting and not enough time publishing, really. So it seemed and it was a wonderful opportunity, frankly, Alex. I mean, it was like a sort of fairy tale, because here was a guy, you know, with a lot of money there wasn't a crushing need to make profit very quickly, and drama is a slow burn operation. You publish a new play by a new author, and you're lucky if it makes any money, and it almost certainly won't make money for years and years until it either, you know, starts to become part of the quite small repertoire of regularly produced plays, or unless it becomes interesting as a subject of study, or if it starts appealing to amateurs. But I mean, most plays don't do that, and most plays are actually a stepping stone to their author's next play. And what you hope eventually is that that author, whoever they are, accumulates a body of work that by and large begins to pay for itself. So it's a very, very slow burn business, and Sebastian Walker understood this when he took me on. So it was a great time, because there was kind of no pressure and quite a lot of money.
And that was 1988.
That was 1988, exactly. And that was 20 years ago.
And the 20 imprint,
years ago today.
The imprint was Nick Hearn Books.
And that's what he told me. I said, what do we call it, Sebastian? Mm. He said, well, I've called my firm Walker Books. You call your firm Nick Hearn Books. I thought this was very grand and rather a little bit immodest, frankly. Mm. But that's what he said, and sheltering under his diktat, that's what I called it, and I'm kind of happy with it now. And it does it has a very small benefit that people joining the list can actually meet someone called Nick Hearn, whereas they can no longer meet either Algernon Methuen or whoever Faber and Faber were. Do you know what I mean? There's a little bit of that which is kind of quite helpful.
As you mentioned before, he died quite soon after that.
Yes, that's right.
And you were then associated with Random House.
That's
How
right.
did that happen?
Well, the Walker thing came to a very, very sad end because, as I said, he got very ill, and in fact, he tried to sort of put his house in order before he died, and that involved it was terrible. That involved dispensing with the very new initiative that he'd started. In other words, we were out in our ear, and it was a very rocky and horrible time because we'd started with such promise, you know, and I won't say, I mean, we'd recruited a lot of authors even in those 2 years, and suddenly, you know, we were out in our ear, and it seemed as though that decision I'd taken was a very, very bad one. But Anthony Cheetham, who was at that stage having himself had an extraordinarily successful publishing career, was running Random House, was similarly, rather like Sebastian, attracted by the idea of building Random House into a collection of, I think the phrase then was, boutique publishers, which meant that, you know, there was as it were, on the first floor you'd have drama and sport, and on the second floor you'd have lifestyle and design, or you know
a
what
kind
I mean.
Of diversity
exactly,
of specialised
exactly
subjects,
that
yeah.
And so he took us on, he acquired the list from Sebastian Walker and took us on. And then and again we had a slightly more rigorous environment, which was no doubt good for us, though we did acquire some very good plays and books during that time as well. But then the bottom dropped out of that because Cheetham himself was sacked by his American bosses in 1992, and I could just see, or it might even have been 1991, we hung on until April 1992 before the people who took over said, well, you know, we're going into reverse, that wonderful corporate phrase, we're concentrating on core activities, which didn't involve drama, it almost never involves drama. So once again we were homeless, and after trying knocking on various doors, I think the country was in the middle of a credit crunch then as well.
Yes, exactly.
So it really wasn't a good time. With a great deal of trepidation, I set up on my own, actually in this house where we're doing the interview, in the back bedroom, classic small publishing stuff.
Yep.
And I set up with a loan from a friend, and with a loan in kind from the people in Australia who do drama publishing, who very kindly thought I'd known them since Methuen days, but who thought this was a good thing, and so lent us some money. And with those two contributions and a bank overdraft, we started. But I did manage to acquire the list as it then existed in 1993.
In those days, I mean, obviously you've expanded since then, but in those days, what kind of problems did publishing theatre books involve?
Well, some of the same ones that we're facing now, though actually, I think it's fair to say that theatre generally and drama publishing in particular have sort of lost ground in the national consciousness. I mean, I think you'll agree that if you look back 20, 25, 30 years ago, my impression anyway is that there simply were more column inches in the paper
yes.
devoted to theatre than there are now. And the same has sort of happened with drama publishing. There, at Methuen, we were reprinting staples like Mother Courage and The Caretaker and Taste of Honey, I remember. There certainly was a time when we did a reprint of 10,000 copies of Taste of Honey and kind of didn't think twice about it, which would be completely inconceivable today. On the other hand, I'm sorry, I've actually screwed up the chronology slightly, but I'll carry on. Today, there are very, very, very many more titles published, but in often tiny quantities. So then there was quite a small body of work that was actually out there, both in terms of plays and theatre books. We were beginning to feel the difficulty, however, of getting new plays into print and not losing money. As I explained earlier, new plays by new writers are kind of the lifeblood that you have to go on recruiting new writers, because who knows who isn't going to be the Carol Churchill or the Colin McPherson of the future, you know? And I mean, Connor's a very good example, because he's achieved an international reputation very, very quickly, which is relatively unusual. Other writers, it takes much longer. So you're struggling for a long time, and you have to find a way of making money, not making money, of trying to make sure that the publication pays for itself. And this is where the programme text scheme comes in, which I started with the Royal Court when I was at Methuen in 1980, and the first one was Stephen Lowe's Touched, I remember. And for a long time, it was only the Court that were doing.
So this is a play text which is published when the play opens, but it's simultaneously a programme, so it has details of the actors, their biographies, and so forth.
Absolutely right. It's an item, a book or a programme, call it what you will, that has two functions. When it's in the theatre, it's a programme. When it's in the bookshops, it's a book. And we kind of try to design it so that it looked different but was actually the same item, because the point being that as a publisher you're always looking for a longer print run, because printing simply it responds to the economy of scale. The more copies you print at any one time, the cheaper those copies are, and therefore the more margin you can make in selling them.
And playtexts as programmes, what would you normally print? 1,000? 2,000?
Varies hugely. Downstairs at the Court, when they're feeling optimistic about that they've got a play by Carol Churchill, for instance, they would place an order of 2,000, maybe even more than that. We do now, this was not true in 1993, but now we're, and it's one of the big changes, we're doing programme texts with almost any theatre that will, that is prepared to work with us, always provided we like the play, of course, in the first place. And we can go down to as few as 500, and even sometimes fewer than that. Though that does make the,
because you've worked with some fringe venues.
Yes, we have, and that's very much the last two or three years we've worked with Finborough and with Theatre 503. I mean, the problems there are that they themselves have no money, so they're very. Publishing as is theatre is a risk, because you just don't know how successful the play is going to be, either on stage or on the page. And so then the point about the programme text scheme is that the theatre has to make a commitment, just as the publisher does. They have to say, okay, we will take 500 copies. They pay for them at cost, which is basically how it all works. They then charge what they want to, but
usually much less than
much less. Yeah. Typically £2.50 or £3. £3, I think, is the
on a book that retails at
very nearly
nine.
Yeah, £8.99 normally. So the audience feels that they're getting a bargain, and the theatre gets, the theatre can still make a profit on that. And the only reason it won't make a profit is if actually it's bought. It turns out the play wasn't as successful as they thought it was going to be, and that means that they, But we hope that mostly the theatre is going to at least break even.
Mm. And since you sort of started out independently in 1993, obviously you've diversified into several areas within drama publishing.
Yeah.
Can you outline some of those?
Well, I suppose, well, since 1990, drama publishing is pretty much, will always be, plays and books about the theatre. But what we have done, I mean, if we're talking about since 1993, we have, we brought on a series of classics, little, actually, they're hardly bigger than a postcard. The format is hardly bigger than a postcard. And this was a mesh from my days as a drama teacher. I mean, I knew that as a teacher I wanted students to read as widely as possible, but that it, you know, that it, that price was a real factor. So we set out to produce a series of classic plays. I mean, everything and anything you can think of.
Since Aeschylus.
Yeah, exactly. Aeschylus to Zola, exactly, yeah. A to Z. Anything that was out of copyright and therefore didn't, although we have done a lot of translations because those are in copyright, but basically where the original is out of copyright. So you're right, it'll go from the Greeks through the Renaissance. It'll include Moliere, Schiller, Goethe, the European greats, right up to almost the present day. We've got Pirandello, who's just gone out of copyright, and Oscar Wilde and so on, in the list. But these were initially published. The series started in 1994 at £2.99 each. So the idea was you could get any classic play you might have to read at £2.99.
And have they been as popular as
they've been very successful. Had they been published by a really big publisher, they would have been really, really popular. But they're very successful from our point of view, and they are greatly they are greatly returned to. Teachers, you know, they see them and they draw their students' attention. So that's one new initiative. And I suppose the other is in the field of books, where I started coming from Methuen, where there was a tradition of publishing books that sat halfway between the theatre and the academy, if you like. Mm-hmm. Ted Braun's books are a very good example of this. Yes. They're still in print with Methuen, books about Meyerhold. They're basically very, very good historical books. You know, this was what theatre was like then. And I tried a few of those when we started with varying degrees of success. But what I found was that because we weren't established in the educational field in the way that Methuen is, we didn't have a name, we simply couldn't sustain these books, and they became very problematic. The sales sort of slumped. If we did run out of stock, it was really difficult to reprint, because we were looking at sales of perhaps only 100 copies a year. But what I was finding was that books on practical aspects of the theatre not only sold but continued selling year after year, because drama schools, universities, sometimes secondary schools would buy them. I'm talking about books on acting, directing, stage management even, design, aspects of acting like voice, slightly specialised books on Laban, a Commedia, all that kind of thing. And the list now, I think, and it's still growing, I mean, we've got a book on producing, so you want to be a producer, coming through. What we try to do is kind of cover the waterfront, so that whatever aspect of theatre craft you're interested in, you can find a book.
And some of these are still in print, aren't they? Oh, Michael Billington's, what's it called?
One Night Stands, yes. That's actually, I mean, it is still in print, and we're proud that it's still in print. And what's funny is that the book has sort of changed its nature. When we published it, it was Michael Billington's 21st anniversary as a critic. And so the book was, in a sense, up to the minute. But that was in 1994. Since then, it was a very interesting pattern. It went into a terrible dive, the dive that I've talked about, and has actually re-emerged from that, because now it's a book about a discrete and distinct period. But actually, Alex, that's the kind of book that I think we wouldn't do now, because it is historical. I like books that a theatre practitioner can learn something from, in terms of...
So, for example, Declan Donnellan's book
is a very good example.
What's it called? The Actor and the Target.
We published it in 2002. It has simply sold almost the same quantity every year since then, which is extraordinary. It simply means that each generation of, I'm assuming that each generation of drama students is acquiring a copy. And it is one of the most read and most bought books on the list. I mean, I can pretty well trust that anybody who's trying to make a living in the theatre, or hopes to make a living in the theatre, has at least knows the book, has at least heard of the book. Quite a lot of them have read it. That is absolutely paradigmatic of the kind of book that we are publishing these days.